Barcelona. Bij mij en bij me zien. In mijn hart Barcelona. Klinkt nog steeds de geluid van gitaren bij nacht. Barcelona, droog nog steeds van je wondere pracht.
Ai, 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 ai.
Barcelona, ik ben met vakantie in Spanje geweest. Het land van de lach en de zon. En is dat in Spanje verveelt me het meest. Ik wou dat ik daar wezen kon. Ja, ja, in Barcelona. Daar vind je romantiek. Ja, ja, in Barcelona. Bij mij en bij muziek.
Thank you.
ben met jou niet getrouwd. Ik heb met jou toch niks te maken. Ik wil niet van je houden, dat zijn toch mijn eigen zaken. Ik ben met jou niet getrouwd. Ik heb met jou toch niks te maken. Ik wil niet van je houden, dat zijn toch mijn eigen zaken. Eerst wil je dit en dan weer dat. Ik ben het beu, ik ben het zat. Ik ben met jou niet getrouwd. Ik heb met jou toch niks te maken. Ik wil niet van je houden, dat zijn toch mijn eigen zaken. Schreeuw nog niet zo in mijn oren. Salut, ordinaire madame. Waar de aard komt naar voren. Dacht je dat ik dat nog nou? Ik ben met jou niet getrouwd. Ik heb met jou nog niks te maken. Ik wil niet van je houden, dat zijn toch mijn eigen zaken. Ik ben met jou niet getrouwd. Ik heb met jou nog niks te maken. Ik wil niet van je houden, dat zijn toch mijn eigen zaken. Eerst wil je dit en dan weer dat. Ik ben het beu, ik ben het zat. Ik ben met jou niet getrouwd. Ik heb met jou nog niks te maken. Ik wil niet van je houden, dat zijn toch mijn eigen zaken. Ik heb genoeg van jouw praatjes, liet ze een ander maar voor. Jij kunt nog lang op me wachten, maar ik ga er heus echt vandoor. Ik ben met jou niet getrouwd, ik heb met jou toch niks te maken. Ik wil niet van je houden, dat zijn toch mijn eigen zaken.
Zo'n pijn, maar nou niet, scheiden doet lijden. Ik blijf je steeds trouw, want ik wil alleen maar jou.
Marina, 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 ti voglio più presto sposar. Marina, 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 ti voglio più presto sposar. Oh mia bella mora, no, non mi lasciar, non mi devi rovinar. Oh no, 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 oh mia bella mora, no, non mi lasciar, non mi devi rovinar. Oh no, 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 no. Mi sono innamorato di Marina, una ragazza mora ma carina, ma lei non vuol saperne del mio amor. Cosa farò per conquistar suo cuore? Un giorno la incontrai sola sola, il cuore mi batteva mille all'ora. Quando gli dissi che la volevo amare, mi diedi un bacio e l'amor scoppiò. Marina, 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 ti voglio al più presto sposar. Marina, 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 ti voglio al più presto sposar. Oh mia bella mora, no, non mi lasciar, non mi devi rovinar. Oh no, 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 no. Oh mia bella mora, no, non mi lasciar, non mi devi rovinar. Oh no, 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 no.
Marina, Marina, Marina,
ti voglio al più presto sposar.
Marina, Marina, Marina,
ti voglio al più presto sposar. Oh mia bella mora, no, non mi lasciar, non mi devi rovinar. Oh no, 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 no. Oh mia bella mora, no, non mi lasciar, non mi devi rovinar. Oh no, 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 no. Oh no, 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 no. Oh no, 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 no.
E l'amore in tuo cuore te si gela. c'era se là, c'era se. Vole dirci sta canzone, te la spresa e sta passione, por mio, se fa l'immonde. Melluna piscentette pumarole, una piante rose tenere e gentile, au viento una camicia e due lenzuole. Questo balcone tuo, tu che stasi, come va se si limone si gerassa sotto il sole cade scarpa te vai doge si fa fritto si innamella e l'amore di tuo cuore te si è gemella c'era se là c'era se vuole dirci sta canzone della sprezza e sta passione cuore mio se fa limone si cerasa si limone c'era se la c'era se
船飞，你会唔会同我一齐走啊
？10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
The ultimate political goal at the heart of our age is the idea of individual freedom.
I believe that freedom is the future of all humanity.
In Britain, our government has set out to create a revolution that will free individuals from the control of old elites and bureaucracies. A new world where we are free to choose our lives, not be trapped by class or income into a predestined role.
To liberate Britain from all the old class divisions, old structures, old prejudices,
to liberate the individual.
And abroad, in Iraq and Afghanistan, Britain and America have set out to liberate individuals from tyranny. For those leading it, it is just a first step in a global revolution for democracy. But if one steps back and looks at what has resulted, it is a very strange kind of freedom. The attempt to liberate people from the dead hand of bureaucracy has led to the rise of a new and increasingly controlling system of management,driven by targets and numbers. While governments committed to creating freedom of choice in all areas have actually presided over a rise of inequalities and a dramatic collapse in social mobility. The consequence has been a return of the power of class and privilege. And abroad, the attempt to create democracy has led not just to bloody mayhem, but a rejection of the American-led campaign to bring freedom.
Go home, Yankee! Go home, Yankee!
Be here for your fucking freedom! So back up right now!
And it has summoned up an anti-democratic, authoritarian Islamism. And this, in turn, has helped inspire terrorist attacks in Britain itself. In response, the government has dismantled long-standing laws designed to protect our freedom. This is a series of films about how this strange, paradoxical world came to be created. This episode tells the story of how in the 1990s, politicians from both the right and the left tried to extend an idea of freedom, modelled on the freedom of the market, to all other areas of society. This was something that previously no one, not even the high priest of capitalism, Adam Smith, had thought possible or appropriate. But now, it was seen as inevitable. Because underlying it was a scientific model of ourselves, as simplified robots. Rational, calculating beings, whose behaviour and even feelings could be analysed and managed by numbers. But what resulted was the very opposite of freedom. The numbers took on a power of their own, which began to create new forms of control, greater inequalities, and the return of a rigid class structure based on the power of money. In 1991, the new leader of the Conservative Party, John Major, was searching for what his advisers called the vision thing, a policy that would define his time in office.
Can we turn left into Atlantic Road in a moment, please? I think I'd like to go down there and have a look. Now, is it still there? It is. It is. It's still there. It's still there.
Pattern was set. World divided. Not into male and female. Oh, no, 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 that's just a mere superficial division of minor importance. No, gentlemen, there is another division, another dichotomy, more basic, more profound. At that fateful moment, the world was divided into winners and losers, top men and underdogs. In a word, the one up. And the one down.
And in July, John Major announced that he was going to make Britain a fairer and more equal society. And he was going to start with the public services. The arrogant bureaucrats who had ruled Britain for so long were now going to be made to serve the public. There would be no them and us any longer.
Nothing less than a revolution in the way in which public services are delivered. It will be the most comprehensive quality initiative ever launched. New and tougher standards of services will be set. The wide range of mechanisms to ensure they're met to the citizen's satisfaction.
Behind John Major's vision was a radical new political theory which had been born out of the strategic thinking of the Cold War. As last week's programme showed, it argued that the idea of public duty, which had underpinned British public life for generations, was an illusion. In reality, public servants were motivated only by self-interest. When they talked proudly of serving the public good, it was hypocrisy. What they were actually doing was scheming to build up their empires. John Major was setting out to create an alternative system that tried to mimic the self-interested drive of the free market. This would harness the true individualism of public servants in a productive way. The management consultants who designed the systems explained that this was liberation. Once public servants were set performance targets, they could achieve them in any way they wanted. The old bureaucratic rules could be thrown away, and they would become heroic entrepreneurs.
Dispel for good our notions of bureaucratic inefficiency and complacency. These people have visions, they set goals, they constantly seek customer feedback, they beat budgets and pursue innovations with zeal.
Right. No introduction.
the bureaucracy-bashing revolution is underway. It's no longer management by the book. And in fact, the book has been rewritten and in some cases literally thrown out.
And anybody that deals with the public, you can never win. You can never win when you deal with the public. Never.
But this radical new theory had an inexorable logic at its heart. It wasn't going to just attack the old bureaucratic institutions. It was going to go much further. It would undermine the very ideals of democratic politics and the politicians' belief that they could change the world. The man who did most to drive through this logic was one of the most influential economists in the world, James Buchanan. His ideas had fundamentally shaped the conservative revolution in both Britain and America. He argued that politicians, just like the civil servants, were hypocrites. The idea they promoted, that they were serving the public, was a fiction. In reality, they too followed their self-interest.
The illusion would be that politics are out, our politicians are out there really seeking to do good for us. Not for themselves, but do good for us. A kind of an optimistic illusion that he's doing good for the public.
Whereas you believe?
We believe that, for the most part, he's after his own interest. I mean, that's where we model his behaviors.
But what about idealism?
Well, I don't know what you mean. You'd have to tell me more about what you mean by the word.
The idea that you're in politics for a greater public good than something you gain for yourself.
Well, I don't think that's meaningful. I don't know how to put any handles on that.
Pat Lyle, your Labour candidate, speaking to you. I ask you to support the Labour Party.
What Buchanan argued was that all politicians followed their self-interest because the idea that they could interpret and express the general will of the people was logically impossible. Behind this view lay not just right-wing ideology, but a scientific theory called game theory. As last week's programme showed, game theory had been used in the 1950s by nuclear strategists. But the idea had then been developed by the mathematical genius John Nash as a way of looking at all social interaction. Individuals lived their lives as a game in which they pursued only their own self-interest, constantly adjusting to each other's strategies. If this were true, the economists argued, then the very idea of the collective people's will was mathematically impossible. You simply cannot add up the millions of competing individual desires into one coherent goal. They called it the impossibility theorem. And the only system they said that could respond to what people really wanted in such an atomized world was the free market, not politics.
In this game theory view of the world, everyone is out for their own personal advantage, and then if you take that as given, then all those individuals want to maximize their pleasure in this very simplified scheme. And that's what the impossibility theorem says. It says they actually do that in the market, but they don't do that in political situations like voting situations.
It's a very narrow view of politics.
Very narrow view of politics, but of course it has to be because it's a narrow view of the human being. But what it does is it reduces what it means to be a human being to a few relatively mechanical principles, that individuals are little information processors, but the market is the best information processor, and voting, or a democracy, is a weak information processor.
Inefficient.
By the early 90s, this argument had come to dominate not just economics, but also the thinking of those who ran the markets. In 1992, Walter Wriston, the head of Citicorp, the largest bank in the world, wrote a bestseller called The Twilight of Sovereignty. In it, he predicted the coming triumph of a new market democracy, where the market would take over the responsibility for running much of society from the politicians. Markets, he said, are the only true voting machines. If they are left untouched by politicians and regulation, they will truly come to act out the people's will for the first time in modern history. And the bankers were about to find a way of making this happen.
Ohio wants change, America wants change, and
and Ohio cast 144 votes for the next president.
Yes!
In 1992, Bill Clinton was running for president. Under George Bush Sr., America had slid into depression, and Clinton promised that he would use the political power of the presidency to rescue the nation.
It's time to change America. George Bush, if you won't use your power to help America, step aside, I will. There is no them, there is only us.
Clinton promised to use the power of the state to reform America's health care, extend welfare, and invest in jobs. And above all, reduce the inequalities that had risen up under President Reagan. And at the end of 1992, he was triumphantly elected. But in January, a few days before his inauguration, two leading members of the financial world came to see Clinton in Washington. One was Alan Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve. The other was Clinton's new economic advisor, Robert Rubin, the head of Goldman Sachs. What they told the president was dramatic. His political plans were impossible. He was inheriting a huge government deficit, and if he borrowed any more money to pay for his promises, interest rates would rise, people would stop borrowing and spending, and there would be an economic disaster.
The single most critical meeting with President Clinton with respect to the economic strategy of the Clinton administration was in early January during the transition, about 2 weeks before the inauguration. And it was at that meeting what we were saying the president was that we need a dramatic change in policy, and it has to be accomplished as much as possible by cutting spending, even though that is very difficult politically.
It was a dramatic message, though, for a Democratic president, wasn't it?
I think any president would have found it a dramatic message, whether Democrat or Republican, to have to start his administration by both reducing programs and cutting spending. And that's very difficult for any politician.
But what both Rubin and Greenspan told Clinton was that there was an alternative way to build a better society. He should let the market do it. Instead of seeing the markets as a dangerous force that politics had to control, he should give away power and let them flourish unrestricted. The markets, they said, were now so intertwined with people's lives that they could respond democratically to people's needs in all aspects of their lives in a way that politics couldn't.
Alan Greenspan communicated a very clear message to Bill Clinton that the economy and people's appetites as expressed in the economy, their buying, their ability to buy, what they prefer, is a better gauge of public sentiment than any other. The economy, to that extent, is superior to democracy. In a democracy, it's less tidy. People can express their preferences only indirectly through their representatives, and their representatives have to express the preferences of a lot of people and sometimes want to express their own preferences rather than their constituents. So in that way of viewing the world, an economy is preferable to a democracy.
Faced with the banker's argument, Clinton agreed, and on taking office, began to cut back on his reforms. During his first term, he dismantled much of the welfare structure that had been put in place in the 1930s. He abandoned all his healthcare reforms and cut government regulation of business. It was what the markets wanted. As Greenspan had promised, the economy began to boom. And in 1996, Clinton made a speech that announced the end of the vision of liberal politics, that one could use the power of big government to change the world.
We know big government does not have all the answers, and we have worked to give the American people a smaller, less bureaucratic government in Washington. And we have to give the American people one that lives within its means. The era of big government is over.
It was the triumph of market democracy, a belief that anyone who gave the public what they wanted was democratic and thus good, as opposed to the old political elites who believed that they knew what was best for us and imposed their idea of what society should be. In the process, businessmen became transformed. They might be greedy and selfish, but they were also engineers of a new kind of freedom. By responding to the needs and desires of individuals, they were interpreting the will of the people in a way that politicians couldn't.
If markets are in fact democracy, if markets are a means of consent, a medium of consent, you know, which all these people believe that they are, there's a very, very commonplace view in the United States these days. In fact, this is a consensus view. It's hard to find someone at the upper reaches of broadcasting, journalism, business, whatever, who doesn't think this. If markets, in fact, are a medium of consent, then you've got all sorts of funny things that come out. Then CEOs are the people who the markets have chosen above all others, are in fact men of the people. They're not some kind of bloodthirsty robber baron like Americans thought they were in the 1930s. When they speak to us, they say, "You speak, we listen," or Fox News, what is it, "We report, you decide," you know, or any of these slogans.
The promoters of this idea of market democracy portrayed it as a glorious return to a golden age, a time in the 18th and 19th centuries when laissez-faire capitalism, not politics, had ordered society. But this was a myth. The political philosophers of that time had made a distinction between the self-interest of the marketplace and other areas of social and political life that involved what Adam Smith called moral sentiments. These were sympathy and understanding for others, which were just as important in the ordering of society. What was happening at the end of the 20th century was something that had never been tried before. The idea of democracy was being taken over by a simplified economic model of human beings. And in the process, freedom was redefined to mean nothing more than the ability of individuals to get whatever they wanted.
If you go back to the 18th and 19th centuries, most political philosophers and most economists understood that there was a social contract. People were bound together, not as individuals expressing themselves only through the marketplace, but as citizens. We had obligations to one another. We were not simply self-interested individuals purchasing things for ourselves, but we were a community. Our very identities, our moral values, came from our relationships in these communities. The view that the market was preferable to politics as a means of giving people exactly what they wanted.